But tonight, there's a Tea Party tidal wave, and we're sending a message to them.
Obama, Pelosi, and Reid are the axes of taxes and socialism, just like Hitler was.
Obama, we do not trust him.
These people are radical.
And first of all, Obama is not a citizen of the United States.
Are all communists.
And he's not a Christian. He's Muslim. And if you read his books, you can find that out.
And I am a big supporter of this movement. I believe in this movement. America is ready for another revolution, and you are a part of this.
Calls for revolution there from Sarah Palin, while evoking the American Revolutionary War at the end of the 18th century. Hi, and thanks for joining me on Rear Vision here on ABC Radio National, Radio Australia, online, and yes, we even tweet. I'm Kate Evans, and today we're tracing the genealogy of the Tea Party movement in the United States.
I'm Jenny Beth Martin with Tea Party Patriots. I'm co-founder and national coordinator of Tea Party Patriots.
This is America. How many of you people want to pay for your neighbor's mortgage that has an extra bathroom and can't pay their bills? Raise their hand.
How about we all...
President Obama, are you listening?
How about we all stop paying our mortgage? It's a moral hazard.
This is like mob rule here. I'm getting scared.
We're thinking of having a Chicago Tea Party in July. All you capitalists that want to show up to Lake Michigan, I'm going to start organizing.
There was a bill in the United States Congress called the Stimulus Bill, and it was a bill to help bail out certain businesses, and the government would be spending more money to take care of businesses that were in trouble. And the thinking is that in Congress was that if they spent more money, then it would help our economy. And there was a host on a news network in America named Rick Santelli. And he had a rant complaining about this bailout package and saying that this isn't what America was designed for. It's not the way we're supposed to work. And he called for us to have tea parties around the country. And these tea parties were reminiscent of when our country was started and we had the Boston Tea Party back in the 1700s. So he had this rant, and then the next day there were a group of us who got on a conference call and started planning the first round of tea parties. And we had tea parties the following Friday, so a week and a day after his rant. We had 48 tea parties around the country with 35,000 people in attendance.
So you were one of those people who, in I think it's February 2009, is that right?
That's correct.
So you were one of those people who heard this and immediately leapt into action.
I sure did. I was already active with groups online, a group called Smart Girl Politics, and also another group called Top Conservatives on Twitter. And so after Rick Santelli had that rant, we started tweeting about it, and the tweeting led to the conference call, and the conference call led to us planning tea parties.
It's been a year since Tea Party protesters first turned out to show their displeasure at high taxes and government spending. And today they were at it again, this time at a big rally in Freedom Plaza in Washington, within sight of the US Capitol building.
I spend way too much money cause my bank told me I could.
Don Miller is one of the protesters. He's hoisting a handmade sign into the air. It shows Barack Obama in a suit decorated with the Soviet hammer and sickle. And it says, "Say no, America, to egotistic dictators."
Because they are taking power away from the people. Basically, the same thing that the Soviet regime has done, and also Nazism. Same type of socialist policies, and I believe that the federal government should not have so much power.
Well, back in the 1700s, before the United States of America actually became the United States of America, we were still colonies of Great Britain. And the colonists were very upset because they were being taxed by England and they weren't getting represented. There was no representation. And they were actually, their tea was being taxed. So this group of people in Boston, Massachusetts, decided they were going to have a tea party, and they dressed up, went onto a ship, and overthrew the tea. And it was a protest to say, we're not going to buy this tea, we're not paying the taxes on the tea. And so that was the way they were having a tea party. And that really was one of the events that helped shape America.
Johnny has gone for a soldier.
Members of the Tea Party look back to an idealised revolution that was relatively simple, a case of disgruntled or dissatisfied patriots banding together and throwing off the British. And in removing all of the complexity of that story of the war for independence and the revolution and the founding of the nation and all of that struggle to make that work, 13 colonies coming together who had less in common with each other than they had with the British, as one historian has said recently, in removing all of that complexity, they've engaged in what a historian, Jill Lepore, has called historical fundamentalism. And here there's, especially in their attitudes toward the founding fathers, the so-called founding fathers, and in particular toward the documents of the period of independence, of the revolution, there's a kind of reverence and a sense that these documents in particular are sacred texts that can be read for what their framers or their authors intended at the time, and that that should be relevant for us still today.
Historian Claire Corbould from Monash University.
We have government that is out of control. It's too big. They're spending our money in ways that they should not be spending our money. After the Boston Tea Party back in the 1700s, we had the Revolutionary War, and then the founders of our country didn't stop there. They wrote down our Constitution and said, this is how a government, the government in America, will work. And we've gotten so far away from the way the Constitution intends for our government to operate. The government's bigger than it should be, and it's spending too much money, and we're trying to get back to the basics in our country.
So what claims were they making about the American War of Independence and that other Tea Party? What claims were they making for it?
Well, it's a set of claims. One is that essentially the modern welfare state, the idea that the state will intervene in the economy, take care of its citizens, which I should say is kind of a misnomer in the United States. We haven't really had that kind of a welfare state for quite a while. It's been pushed back. But the idea was that welfare state is a tyrannical state, akin to the tyranny of King George III, invading people's privileges, people's rights, and in particular in the case of the health care plan, the right to, you know, your own doctor, the right to, make your own way. To really make your own way, and that the government is going to step in and stop you. Now, it was complete, fantasy. I mean, if anything, the health care reform that went through, should have gone far more in the direction, many people believe, of state intervention. But that was the kind of claim that they were making. But there was an edge to it, particularly as we get back to that mortgage issue, which is that it's a kind of Darwinian view, and this is not at all in the American Revolution at all. But these guys have a very Darwinian view that there are winners and losers in society. There are people who are strong and there are people who are weak, they're smart, they're dumb, and that government should not be in the business of propping up those types of people. In fact, to the extent that the government does, it reproduces the kind of old regime where the state, gave people feudal privileges and titles. Only now they think that the recipient of government largesse is not feudal lords, but losers.
Corey Robin, Associate Professor of Politics at Brooklyn College, New York. His latest book is a history of conservatism in America entitled The Reactionary Mind. So while the Tea Party references the American War of Independence, the Revolutionary War, he suggests taking a longer view to trace its political lineage.
I think you really need to go back to the formation of conservatism as both an idea and a practice. And historians have some disagreement about this, but I would say that the general consensus is that conservatism really arises in reaction to the French Revolution, to the claims, to the really radical and modern claims of freedom, equality, and fraternity that the French Revolution puts forward, and the reaction against those ideas. And this is something that's not a very well understood process, but what's so fascinating about conservatism is that it arises in reaction to these ideas. It's extraordinarily hostile to these ideas, consistently across time and across space. And yet, it oftentimes borrows from the very radical and revolutionary movements that it is opposing. So what this means in terms of the Tea Party in particular is that in the reaction against the French Revolution, what you see for the first time is defenders of the old regime against the revolution beginning to understand that if they're going to really mount a defense against these radical revolutionary ideas, that they need to in some ways co-opt the populist and dynamic and mobilizing dimensions of the revolution itself. And that's what's so extraordinary and fascinating about the conservatism that gets mobilized against the French Revolution. We oftentimes think of it as very aristocratic and very stuffy, and it is very aristocratic, but it's a populist defense of aristocracy, oftentimes. And this, I think, is in some ways really the kind of the key of understanding how conservatism works. And it's something that gets people very confused about the Tea Party because it seems so grassroots. It seems like it has its own kind of democratic dimension, and people think, well, then is it on the left or is it the right? But that's the way conservatism has always been. It has been always trying to extract from democracy some kind of resource on behalf of anti-democratic movements.
And yet, as these conservative traditions leap from country to country, they're transformed. Not only that, they respond to or against particular events. So from the French Revolution, we jump forward another 50 years in America to the 1840s. Dr. Claire Corbould again.
To understand its formation, if you like, I think you go back to the 1840s, which really was the first big populist movement took off in the United States. And there have been several over the years, usually at times of unrest, economic depression, you know, those kind of tumultuous periods where a number of people feel that they've been displaced somehow from the centre and form parties, either political parties or movements, to try to regain some of that sense of belonging to the nation.
Belonging can also be expressed by collective action and street protest. And so to touch on another of the traditions from which the Tea Party emerges, we take another leap of a half century or more with investigative journalist and documentary filmmaker Geoffrey Dunn. His book, The Lies of Sarah Palin, The Untold Story Behind Her Relentless Quest for Power, has just been released.
If you go back to World War I, with the emergence of a major labor movement in the United States, you see that activism, in the street activism, is pretty much limited to the left and progressive movements of the Democratic Party in this country. That holds true through the 1930s, the 40s, and of course into the 60s, where the civil rights movement develops and becomes an activist in the street movement. The Tea Party movement is the first time in the last 100 years where you've actually seen conservatives take to the streets and engage in formal protesting. This is new. It's significant, and anyone who wants to deny that significance is also missing an important aspect of this movement.
Conservatism, as I've said, is always a reaction against a movement of emancipation. The movements will change throughout time. So you have the French Revolution, you have abolition, you have the women's movement, the civil rights movement, what have you. But it's always a movement of emancipation. And what these movements of emancipation are asking for, beyond the abstraction of freedom and equality, is really for some kind of self-rule, that just to make the claim, I don't belong to somebody else, I belong to myself. And we're very familiar with that claim, and for very good reasons, all of us, or many of us at least, are very, you know, believe in those ideals. But we forget a flip side of that claim. If I belong to myself, I belong to myself is not just an abstract claim. It's a claim against a different argument. It's a claim against those who say, no, you belong to me. So if you're a wife, that you belong to your husband. If you're a slave, that you belong to your master. If you're a worker, that you belong to your employer. If you're a serf, that you belong to your lord. When you make these radical claims of self-rule, I belong to myself, and if you're successful in pressing those claims, your master, your husband, your employer experiences a loss. Sometimes it's quite real in terms of it's quite material, a form of loss. People forget this, but emancipation of black slaves was one of the largest forms of expropriation of private property in world history. It was huge. And that's a real material loss to those slaveholders. But it's also a kind of loss of status, and ultimately sometimes a loss of identity. So loss, I think, is just pervasive. But what's more common is then the claim of conservatives to make that loss whole. Conservatism is a project of restoration, and that's what gives, I think, conservatism such a dynamic, powerful force, because it appeals to this experience loss. I mean, all of us have lost something. The Reagan Revolution is an attempt by employers, and also by, in the form of the, when you look at the religious right, in the form of fathers, to reclaim privileges that had been lost under the New Deal, the Great Society, and the sexual revolution. And to some degree, they were successful. You know, American employers today are in a much, much more powerful position than they were, let's say, in the 1950s. And that's in part what the Tea Party is about as well. It's a little bit more ambiguous what the losses are that they're trying to make, but you see this kind of rhetoric all the time of a desire to return to another place in time when something was different, and an effort to recover that.
I think the Tea Party is about taking our country back. I love history, studied history all my life. I've studied what the country was founded upon, and what's happening right now is not what the country was founded for.
So taking your country back from who?
From, well, communists, I think, is part of it. The liberals, the statists. I don't think it's right. The country...
On Rear Vision today, here on ABC Radio National and Radio Australia, the Tea Party movement in America.
I'm on my way, freedom land. I'm on my way, what a freedom land.
I still have a dream.
I'm on my way.
It is a dream deeply rooted in the American dream.
I think the best place to find the origins of the modern Tea Party movement are in the 1960s, late 1960s, and especially the 1970s. And that's a period of profound upheaval, not just in the United States, of course, all over the world, but if we're talking about the United States, it's a time when bombings and shootings and riots and protests and a sense that revolution was actually possible again. And... yeah, it's also then the rise of the modern conservative movement.
As we look at America, we see cities enveloped in smoke and flame. We hear sirens in the night. We see Americans dying on distant battlefields abroad. We see Americans hating each other, fighting each other, killing each other at home.
Richard Nixon, President Richard Nixon, is the most... able at tapping into that dissent of the 1960s and 70s as the group of people he referred to as the silent majority, a phrase that's been tossed around a lot in the last couple of years again. Richard Nixon was the one who managed to tap into the sense among many working class, lower middle class, white Americans by and large, that they were losing out somehow, that social movements of the 1960s and 70s had served not just to bolster the claims of African-Americans, of women, gays and lesbians, of all sorts of different groups, but had at the same time cost them their place in the American nation.
Listen to the answer to those questions. It is another voice. It is a quiet voice, in the tumult of the shouting. It is the voice of the great majority of Americans, the forgotten Americans, the non-shouters, the non-demonstrators.
Yeah, I mean, I think if we were to really look at the long durée of the modern American conservative movement, again, people will debate when it begins and how you periodize it, but I would say one of the really critical moments is it's a forgotten moment by many people. It was in California in the late 1970s. There was a movement, elite-driven, but had tremendous grassroots support for a referendum for Proposition 13, which puts severe limitations on how much the state could tax its citizens. And not just the state, but all governments throughout the state. And the anti-tax dimension of the Republican Party is probably, you know, I mean, the Republican Party has lots of factions, but I would say that's probably the kind of strongest glue at the policy level. You know, anybody who's a candidate for Congress on the Republican ticket has to basically sign the no-tax pledge. You know, they're all beholden to it. And that really has put a kind of a lock on American politics, because it really determines what you can do. If you can't raise taxes, you're in trouble.
Political scientist Corey Robin, whose history of conservatism in America is called The Reactionary Mind. You also heard historian Claire Corbould there. Journalist Geoffrey Dunn views the Tea Party movement through the character of Sarah Palin, who, he argues, both epitomises the movement and embodies the right-wing talk radio version of America. She has, he argues, shifted the tenor of political rhetoric there.
Look, I think it's fair to say that she taps into two historical flows in American politics. One, I even myself align myself with in some way. I view myself as a fiscal conservative. I think that American government has gotten much too large, much too invasive. There are far too many layers of bureaucracy in this country, and our national debt has just grown to exorbitant amounts. And I have always identified as a Democrat or a progressive leftist in this country, but my own party has failed to address those issues. So I can understand the linkage with her identification as being a fiscal conservative and someone who wants to peel back government invasion in our lives. But the second sort of flow in American politics that she taps into is a little more troubling. And this one has elements of racism attached to it, elements of disdain for foreigners, elements of violence, and really revolves around sort of this militia type mentality. And she taps into that as well. In truth, she honors neither of those traditions with her behavior and her experience and her actual history, but the image of her, what I call a meme, if you will, is one that is attractive to people with those two tendencies.
We're taking back America.
I believe that Obama's health care package, which I supported in general, but which I was strongly critical of in the way it was brought about, has played a central role in the Tea Party movement and in its generating interest and opposition to Obama. Now, of course, Palin tapped into the notion of death panels as associated with the Tea Party, and I was absolutely appalled by that. I have a daughter who has significant health issues, and yours truly, 6 years ago this month, was dead on an operating table with advanced and aggressive cancer. So I know what it means to have to deal with end-of-life decisions. To call them death panels was absolutely outrageous, and I might add, fiscally irresponsible, because all economic studies show that dealing with end-of-life decisions practically and morally and ethically bring down healthcare costs.
Healthcare is just one of the many areas of government policy targeted by the Tea Party. But there is no single strategy or agenda for such a diverse movement. Indeed, the relationship of the Tea Party to mainstream American politics and the party system is particularly difficult to pin down.
You know, the Republican Party is a standard political party, and the Tea Party is, or at least has the trappings of being a popular movement, and oftentimes quite disconnected from the party. I mean, there's something on the order, I don't know the exact number, but at least 6 or 7 formal Tea Party organizations, all under the rubric of Tea Party. There's Tea Party Works. They have slight differentiations in the nomenclature. But, you know, they're different organizations. Now, some of them are obviously very closely tied with the Republican Party. So, for instance, Richard Army is the head of one of these organizations. He was the majority leader of the Republican Party in the House of Representatives up until a couple years ago, or 4 or 5 years ago. So, you know, he's an insider who is now presiding over an organization of putative outsiders. But there are others that are much more disconnected from the party. And so this is a long way of saying that I think it's an extraordinarily complicated relationship that I think follows two tracks. On the one hand, it's very clear that the Tea Party is an arm of the Republican Party and has provided the shock troops for Republican victories in the House of Representatives in 2010 and somewhat in the Senate as well. And the Republican Party feels, that these are the ground troops that are going to propel it to victory in 2012 in the presidential election. So there's that dimension, which is important. And it's very much an elite project to that degree. There is, however, part of the Tea Party that is not beholden to the party, that is much more of a grassroots organization, and that has caused tremendous amount of headache for the Republican Party, because this is a part of the Tea Party that is against the bank bailouts, which was, after all, the program that George W. Bush pursued, that dislikes corporate America and sees the state in collusion with it and dislikes Wall Street. And so this creates a lot of tension. And so there's some people who have speculated, I wouldn't go this far, that the real challenge of the Republican Party today is that it's sort of the lunatics are in charge of the asylum, that a movement that was kind of nurtured and seeded as a way for the Republican Party to win back power. And again, there's a long history of these types of movements. The Christian right was the same thing in the 1970s and 1980s. But that a movement that was, you know, kind of pushed by the party has now become the tail wagging the dog.
But what happened was, and this is really important to understanding the Republican Party, and I think also to understanding the role of the Tea Party in American politics. The Republican Party is a bifurcated party. It's not a united party, and it never has been one. There have always been sort of two wings to the party, and there's a fairly large chasm between the two. To make it simple, let's say that one side of the party is the establishment wing of the party, and you have figures like George Herbert Walker Bush, Nelson Rockefeller, more moderate Republicans, business-oriented Republicans in that wing of the party. On the other side of the party, you have what I'll call the cowboy wing of the party, and that varies on who it might be. At one point, Ronald Reagan was that wing of the party. At another point, Barry Goldwater, or even a John McCain has been from that wing of the party. But the two parties, wings of the party, distrust each other, okay? What the Republican Party is going to have to do in 2012 is unite this movement under the big tent of the Republican Party if they hope to take over the White House. I see a lot of fissures there right now.
Fissures or not, it's likely the Tea Party will continue to play a role as the United States moves towards its elections in 2012. And we hope to bring you the full version of that interview with Geoffrey Dunn on Radio National later this year. You also heard political scientist Corey Robin, historian Claire Corbould, and Jenny Beth Martin from the Tea Party Patriots. I'm Kate Evans, reading the tea leaves here on Rear Vision.